My name is Joe Repstock, and I am an alcoholic. Jerry, that wasn't spiritual. That was crazy. But I did tell her that I was a spiritual speaker. And I gave her 1 hour to leave the room. Jerry, I would like to start by giving you a little French message. And it goes like this, and then I'll give it to you in English. Mettez le bouchon dans la jog, et après ça, vous aimez comme un picochon l'aime la boue. And that means, Jerry, continue putting the plug in the jug, and I will love you like a little pig loves mud. Next Friday, or this Friday, whatever it is, August the 16th of this month, I will be celebrating 20 years of sobriety. And that I am very grateful for, because I know that if it would not be for the grace of God and Alcoholics Anonymous, that I wouldn't be standing here this morning. By all hook or crook, myself and many in this room should not be here today. It's only through a loving God that has directed us to a program of recovery that I stand here to talk to you this morning. Now, July the 16th of last month is another very important day of my life. My wife Boogie and I, her name is Boogie, celebrated 40 years of continuous marriage. She didn't clap like that for the first 20 years, believe me. So we had 20 years of drinking in marriage and 20 years of being sober in marriage. And do you know there were maybe more problems in sobriety than there was in marriage when I was drinking because of the disease of alcoholism that was not arrested at that time. I heard many speakers talk about it. But we tried to do many things that our big book says for us to do. It says we try to avoid arguments and retaliation. We try. There's also in the chapter to the wise where it says when you are having a discussion that begins to be a heated argument, it says the best thing to do is smile and look at each other and say, this is serious and let's talk about it later. We tried that too. Not necessary that everything that is in the book that I put into total practice. But we did try. But it's been a good marriage. And I thought there was something wrong with me when I first came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I would hear a speaker come up here and talk about their fifth wife, their seventh husband, and here we've only been married once. I thought I had done something wrong. I thought it was a qualification for being an Alcoholic Anonymous, but I found out that it was not. And we have these arguments at times, in fact, some very recently, maybe sometimes on a daily basis. I'm joking about that. It's not all that serious. But she said that we were joking about it, that she was going to leave, and that's in sobriety. And I said, well, go ahead and leave. I'm packing me a little suitcase, and I'm going to follow you. So it hasn't been all that bad. I enjoyed all of the speakers so far. Everyone had a terrific message, the AA and the Al-Anon. And I don't want to pick on our Al-Anon speaker because I love her so dearly. But in her story, she gives me that impression. You know, there's a little saying in Al-Anon that I love. And she didn't repeat it yesterday, but I heard it before. And it goes something like this. The other nine says, if you love someone, set it free. If it doesn't come back, it wasn't meant to be. Well, that's a beautiful saying for Al-Anon. But I'm married to a Cajun woman. And I'll tell you about how they say it down the bayou where I live. They say it this way. If you love someone, set it free. If he doesn't come back, go hunt and kill the son of a bitch. I come from a little town called Golden Meadow. A lot of people want to know where Golden Meadow is. I don't blame you for trying to find out where Golden Meadow is. It's not all that popular. It's a little town about 80 or 90 miles south of New Orleans. And I live basically in what they call the marshland of southeast Louisiana. I live in the bayou country. And it's a very small town, and there's a bayou that splits the town in half and dumps into the Gulf of Mexico. And everybody built on the side of the bayou. Years ago, when the settlements first came to Golden Meadow, they built these four-frame houses, and they had a toilet, a commode outside. And then nowadays, they build $100,000, and they used to, in those days, they used to cook inside and use the commode outside. But nowadays, because of the oil industry, people build $100,000 home, and they cook, they use the toilet inside, and they cook outside. So there has been a progress within these years. So that's why we call a bayou, because it passed by your house. You know, our big book talks about perceptions and reality. And if anyone have heard Clancy speak, I'm not here to tell Clancy's story, that's for sure. But he says that reality, he says that alcohol instantly alters your perception of reality. And when I heard him say these words, those were fancy words for a Cajun like myself. So I went to the Cajun dictionary, and what that tells me that alcohol instantly alters my perception of reality, all it means to me that it changed my views, my outlook of what is real and not real, or what is false or true. And this is what I have the interpretation of what a statement of that nature means. And the only reason I'm bringing you all of this wisdom this morning is that I want to tell you a Cajun story in reference to how alcohol alters, changes the views and outlook of what is real and not real. And my three favorite characters from down the bayou, one, his name is Tijon Boudreau, and he drinks at Fontenot Saloon, and the barmaid, well, her name is Marie Thibodeau, very good French Cajun name. And Tijon comes to the bar every day. He sits in that little stool. He drinks his beer, and he looks in his pocket. And he drinks his beer, and he looks in his pocket. And he does it over and over again. And then after a while that he has a few beers, when he looks in his pocket, he starts to smile a little bit. And that is, Marie is climbing the wall. She cannot stand that anymore. She says, Tijon, why do you do that? Oh, he says, Marie, he says, that's the picture of my wife. When she's going to start looking good, I'm going to go home. So, alcohol did alter his perception of what is real and not real. And I'm sure there are many here in this auditorium who can tell us all of the things that alcohol did for you and all what alcohol did for me. You know, I'd like to start by reading a couple of sentences that's very, I think, very apropos to myself in our big book. But you know, before I read it, when I first came to Alcoholic Anonymous, and I would hear a speaker quote the big book, and my opinion was of that guy was that he was a smart aleck, show-off. But then when he would quote the page number, I said, oh my God, he is really a smart ass. Well, I want to tell you what it says on page 30. The chapter more about alcoholism. The sixth line from the top page. The idea that somehow, someday, he will control his drinking is the great obsession of every abnormal drinker. The persistence of this illusion, this continuation of this illusion, is astonishing. Many pursued it into the gate of insanity or death. Not much of a choice. To pursue this obsession that I had to drink, that I could control my drinking, and this illusion that I had that I could control this drinking, gave me but two choices. I either was going to die insane, I was going to be total death, total insanity, or death. And do you know, I've heard it many times, and we talked about it, Charlie and I, a few times, and I don't know I don't have any proof and statistics in Alcoholic Anonymous, but 90% of all the drunks in the world die drunk. Not a very great percentage. This might sound like to start a meeting on a negative basis, but facts are facts. And if it is even more than less than 90%, it's a great percentage to know that I today, just for today, I am one of the 10%. Men in the audience here today, you're in the 10%. You know, there's an old saying in Cajun country and I'll give it to you in French. Il n'y a pas de capitaine dans le brouillard. There are no captains in the fog. For a captain to continue in the same course and in the fog is total disaster or can even cause death. And he could have all the best equipment in the world, but if to continue in this course is disastrous. And it was the same thing for me. Thank God to God's graces in Alcoholic Anonymous that I did not continue on the course that I was going, because I would not be here tonight. You know, at this time I would like to thank the committee for inviting me to be here today. I also would like to thank the Fruit Committee for the basket of fruit that I received in my room. I noticed that none of the other speakers mentioned it. I want to thank the committee for inviting me to be here, to share my experience, my strength, and my hope. Hopefully that I do have a message of hope today. Because I do believe that Alcoholic Anonymous has the fullness of all hope for us. And you know, I heard H-O-P-E, I heard it at the podium, hear other people's experiences. You know, I worked for a tugboat company. And if I was to, and we have many, many equipment on a tugboat. I did not work on the vessel itself, I worked in the office. as a purchasing agent. And if I was to utilize one piece of equipment on a tugboat to symbolize hope in Alcoholics Anonymous, I would use a ship's anchor. And the reason I say a ship's anchor, because we use these anchors on our vessel to hold on to something solid, to be safe and secured against, like going against the rocks. And this is why I would use a ship's anchor as a symbol of hope in Alcoholics Anonymous, because I want my program to be solid, and I want it to be safe and protected against that first drink, which had happened to be scotch on the rocks. And I want to share a most current event that happened. I think it's very humorous. It has nothing to do with Alcoholics Anonymous. I was sitting in my living in reference to the anchor being a symbol of hope. I'm sitting in my living room, and President Bush comes on TV, and he's talking to 100 million people, and he's sharing his experience of going to Poland and visiting the shipyard. And he said upon entering the shipyard, they had three crosses, and in the cross was embedded three anchors. And somebody told him, and he said, that he was told that the anchor was a symbol of hope. Well, when he said that, believe me, this Cajun jumped about this high. And I said, Boogie. I said, did you hear what Bush said? That the anchor was a symbol of hope? And you know, in all of her alanine wisdom, she says, Joe, he most probably heard your talk. I have no defense against that first drink. That defense must come from a power greater than myself. Alcohol is poured into my system. Alcohol comes in bottles. Alcoholism comes in people. And there are things that are poison to my system in which I have defense against. And the reason I mentioned that is because I want to share a story that happened to me many, many years ago before coming to Alcoholics Anonymous. Being a Cajun and living in Cajun country where hunting and fishing is been my lifestyle, Cajun tradition for all these years. I still do hunting, and I was building a hunting blind to go duck hunting. And I was encountered by three cottonmouth water moccasins. Now that is poison to your system. And the trapper who was with me gave me the gun, handed the gun over, and I killed the three cottonmouth water moccasins. Well, you would say, Joe, what the hell are you talking about here about cottonmouth water moccasins? Well, for myself alone, knowing what alcohol did to me, for me, what it did to my family, my immediate family, and what it did to many of my friends, I would take my chances any day of the week with three cottonmouth water moccasins instead of taking that first drink. Because when I take that first drink, I am not the same person anymore. There's something that happens to me. I have tried to describe it many times, like when I take that first drink, it comes to the pit of my stomach, and then it sends an electrifying message back to my brain. And it says, Joe, you had one, let's have another one. Let's have another one. I have no defense against that first drink, because alcohol leads me by the nose. You know, a big book talks about intuitive thoughts or inspiration. Intuitive thoughts, I believe, is an immediate insight that this power that is given through us, that we think of things that I know that I'm not capable of thinking of. I know that it doesn't come from me myself. And one day I had that thought about this intuitive thought about being led by the nose. And I visualized myself as a big old white oxen. You ever see this big old white oxen? They stand on 4 feet and they sway from side to side. He weighs about 2,000 pounds and he has a big ring in his nose. And this puny kid weighs about 50 pounds. And he comes there and he puts his little finger in the ring of that, the nose of that oxen, and he drags that oxen all over where he wants to. And that's how I visualized myself with alcohol. I had no control of what I did or didn't do. Alcohol really led me by the nose. But you know, today, I don't mind being led by the nose. If it is by the spirit of the universe, I heard somebody talk about it today, yesterday. Or maybe any kind of spirit that you know, the spirit of God, or the Holy Spirit, whatever. I don't mind being led by the nose. Or for the man who 12-stepped me. For the man who 12-stepped me in the hospital when I was there for alcoholism, who became my sponsor. I will be eternally grateful for this man of Alcoholic Anonymous, through the grace of God that he came and he 12-stepped me in the hospital. Because I was in the hospital because of alcoholism. And I was only 42 years old. And I knew that my life was at an end, that I knew that I couldn't go anymore. But I didn't know there was any help for me. I thought that I was doomed, like the book says in the doctors, in the opinions, that the doctors in those days, even today, that we alcoholics are, chronic alcoholics are doomed. And he came and he 12-stepped me and he talked to me about his story. He told me his story. He didn't spank my hand. He didn't tell me what I should do. He knew how sick I was. They did not put alcoholism on the medical sheet because they didn't know the insurance company would pay for it in those days. What they did, they put that I had a nervous condition. Believe me, I had a nervous condition. But he said, Joe, if you do what we ought to do, we can survive in Alcoholic Anonymous. And you say, like I said, I was 42 years old and I knew that I was going to die, that there was no more chance for me. And I believe what happened to me, somewhere along the journey to my sobriety, I said, God, help me. And I think that God gave me grace. God helped me and God gave me grace. Now, I didn't know what grace meant when I first came to Alcoholic Anonymous. It's divine, unmerited divine assistance. I did nothing to merit the grace. I can reject the grace. I can ask for the grace. I can accept the grace. It might come to me unintentionally, uninvited. But grace is a gift, I believe, from God. And being 42 years old, knowing that I was going to most probably die, that my life was at an end, I think I took advantage of the grace. And I came to a program of recovery and a program of action called Alcoholic Anonymous. And I believe that the first action that I had to take when I came to Alcoholic Anonymous was come to the meetings. You see, I think Alcoholic Anonymous is something like my mother was. AA is a program of repeat. She repeatedly used to tell me. She said, Joe, brush your teeth. Joe, brush your teeth. Joe, brush your teeth. If you don't brush your teeth, something bad is going to happen. And it's like an Alcoholic Anonymous. Come to the meeting. Joe, come to the meeting. If I don't come to the meeting, maybe something might happen to me. And I don't take that chance. So I come to Alcoholic Anonymous. And this is where I took advantage of the grace. If I don't work the steps of Alcoholic Anonymous, I suffer from what I call the case of the Jeffs. J-E-F-F. Jealousy, envy, fears, and frustrations. While I was drinking and in sobriety. And I'd like to share some of these jests that I had. Or maybe some of my loneliness. You know, a big book says, loneliness as few will ever know. And you know about the loneliness that I'm talking about. I could have been in a crowd of people, as many shrimp as we have in the Gulf of Mexico. And I was one of the most lonesome person in the world. And what were some of my sensitivities? They said that we alcoholics are very sensitive people. It takes some of us a long time to get rid of such a serious handicap. I didn't realize that my sensitivity was such a handicap. I know it now. I know it more in sobriety now about sensitivity than I knew when I was drinking. You know, what was some of my emptiness? Oh, you hear many people talk about that gut, that hole in your stomach that you have, that gut feeling, that hollow gut, like the wind would go right through it. Well, the Cajun doesn't have a hole, he has cracks. Just like the cracks that I had in my wooden boat. But the caulking compound took care of those cracks. On a temporary job, that's all it did. And that's how alcohol used to fill my cracks. But it was only to a temporary job. Because the next day it was there again. It took every bit of what we see on the board, the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, that we can fill these cracks on a permanent basis. Now, what were some of my jealousy? I wasn't jealous of my wife because she's such an attractive woman. I had to put that in. She told me to do so. I wasn't jealous of her. I was jealous more of the attention that she was giving our children. Because I was the type of alcoholic who likes to possess and control. And we lost, my wife is a diabetic, and because of the disease that she has, we lost 6 children. I have 2 living sons today. And we lost 6 children, and some lived for 24 hours and less or more. And there was never, and it's hard for me to say, but it's a fact. There was no remorse as to losing these children. Because I knew that all of these children would change my lifestyle. This was my selfishness, my self-centeredness, that I didn't want these children, although I played the big act. Oh, do I love these kids. And I used to put a big show. I used to, the day of the funeral, I'd put them in the trunk of my car in a little coffin. And then all of our friends were waiting at the funeral, at the graveyard. And I would open up the trunk and I'd carry those babies, dead babies, and all my friends would come and tell me how sorry they were and all of that. And I played a beautiful life. You know, Ed, last night, talked about, if you were here, he talked about his father. That his father died in the condition that he told his father what he told his father. And that Ed would never have been able to make the amends direct. I gotta be honest. This morning I woke up at 4 o'clock. By some mysterious way, I do get nervous when I come to podium. You know, I've always been. It goes away immediately I get here. But in my bathroom this morning at 4 o'clock, I thought about Ed, which I love so dearly. And I love and the story that he told us. And those 2 children that are buried in our graveyard in Golden Meadow popped up in my mind. And I cried like a baby this morning. I cried like a baby sitting over my commode. Because things were coming back. Some of the things that I felt. But I did make amends to these children when I was sober, when I sobered up. And I went to the graveyard. And I told them that Dad did not mean all of the things that I felt. That it was because of my alcoholism. That the things that I did. That I didn't have remorse for my children who died. But those are angels, if I believe what I believe today. So I have no concern about that today. I think they're praying for that dad anyway. Thank you, Ed, for sharing that last night. It brought me back. That's the greatest part of Alcoholics Anonymous, is what we hear at these meetings. That maybe help us to put our lives back in focus, where there is avenues that are not right. I know that it has done it for myself. You know, what were some of my frustrations? When I first came to Alcoholics Anonymous, they talked to me about HALT, H-A-L-T. Don't get too hungry, too angry, too lonesome, too tired. And one of my greatest frustrations in sobriety is when I get a very hunger pain, when I get hungry, and then I get frustrated, because if I don't eat right away, I get angry. So I have to watch myself on these things on a daily basis. You know, fears is the first manifestation of the disease of alcoholism. And many, many years before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, they sent me to a mental institution because they thought that I was crazy, and I was, because of the fears today that I had. The fears that I had in those days was ungrounded, unexplainable. There's no way that I can put into words how I was consumed with these tremendous fears. That I used to sleep in a closet. I used to hide in the closet because of fears that people were going to come and harm me. I used to sleep in my living room with a loaded shotgun, thinking that people were going to harm me. But there was nobody there to harm me. None whatsoever. And this is why they sent me to this mental institution. And I had visualized, I had read about mental institution. They had brought me that morning. I was sober. The doctor had recommended I go to see this psychiatrist at this institution. And I had visualized the pads in the cell, like somebody mentioned, Ed mentioned, I think, yesterday. And there was no one knob on the outside. And I wasn't crazy. What the hell am I doing here? And he met me in the hallway, and after two sessions, he says, "I can't find anything wrong with you, son. Never once did the man say, 'Joe, do you drink?'" I'm not here to knock psychiatrists. I'm sure they have helped many people. But he said, "Do you drink?" And I gave him the most honest answer that you could imagine, and it was the truth. I told him, "No more than the average person." No more than the average person. And I was totally honest about that. If I envied somebody in my life, I had a brother who I substituted as my father, who I got to love. And come to find out, when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, when I sobered up, that my love for my brother was out of fear. My whole life was dominated by his feelings. We were in a partnership together. And depending on how he felt the morning he came to work, depended on the day that I was going to have. I feared him, and I thought I loved him. And then that love turned to hate, to the point that I was wishing that he would get killed, not that I could kill him, but that he would get killed and then I could have all of that material goods, thinking that this is what I needed for happiness. And one night, through his own admission, my brother is older than I am, I've been sober 20 years, and he's still drinking. A fight one night, he almost killed me with a chair. And when I went to work the next morning, he says, "It's best that you don't come back." I am the only person that I know that was asked not to come back in his own business. And out of fear, I didn't go back. But you know, I made my amends. I made my amends to my brother. I made amends to a lot of people after I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I made amends to my mother that the reason I did not visit her as often, she was in bed, sick, and the reason that I would not visit my mother as often as I did is because the fear of knowing that my brother lived in the same yard. But thank God that all this is over today through God's grace in Alcoholics Anonymous, and the best way I could make my amends, I did it this way. He had a birthday, I knew his birthday because it was the same date as my mother, May the 4th, and I sent him a card, a birthday card, and I told him that I loved him. And I was in AA for quite a while, and I meant it. And I have taken care of my amends with my brother. You know, sometimes there's a newcomer that comes to Alcoholics Anonymous and we tell him, come on and sit down, son. Everything is going to be all right in your life. There's no, Alcoholics Anonymous doesn't guarantee me that. Everything is not going to be all right. My relationship with my brother today is no better than it was 20 years ago. And we might go to the grave with that. I don't know. But I have made my amends. I have cleaned the side of my sidewalk. Now, if it takes an early drunk, would have been the single cause of my alcoholism, or if it would have taken the environment in which I lived in, would have been the single cause of my alcoholism, or if I were to inherit the genes from my family, would have been a single cause of my alcoholism, I qualify in all three. I believe today, and it's not important that I know this or not, that maybe there is no single cause to alcoholism. It's a combination of factors. Plus the fact that I drank alcohol. Alcohol did for me what it did not do to another person. I know from not drinking alcohol, there's a lot of things that did not happen. But it did not treat my alcoholism. Stopping drinking did not treat my alcoholism. It just stopped me from doing some of the things that alcohol caused me to do. The first time I ever consumed alcohol, I was 5 years old and I got drunk. Now you might say this is a big deal. It's not a big deal for a kid to get drunk at the age of five. The thing is that there are two things that I remember that happened when I got drunk at 5 years old. That I didn't stop after the first drink, and I didn't drink well. It was a pattern of my life, all of my life, until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm not here to argue if I'm a born alcoholic or not. But a big book says that if you honestly want to, and if you cannot quit entirely, you have no control of the amount you take, you are probably alcoholic. And if that be the case, you're suffering from an illness. You're suffering from an illness which only a spiritual experience will conquer. Now you tell a newcomer that he comes to Alcoholics Anonymous, and for him to recover from alcoholism is that he has to have a spiritual experience. Well, you better throw a rope on him right away, because he's going to take off. But hold them long enough to tell them that the experience comes as a result of our steps, of the power of our steps of recovery. So I worked in a barroom when I was 10 years old. I was a bartender at the age of 12. I used to rack pool tables, and I got pretty good at playing pool. It became an obsession to play pool. And I come to find out when I quit drinking, I never played pool. So evidently it was not for the pool playing that I went out, it was for the drinking, not knowing that it was. Now when I was 14 years old, I could walk, you know, I could do it. I was a bartender at the age of 12, and you say, well, that's almost impossible. Well, you got to remember where I'm coming from. In a small town where the sheriff of the parish used to deputize the owner of the place, and the owner could do anything that he wanted. And the owner was my father. So I could do anything that I wanted as a kid of 10 and 12 years old. I could walk into a saloon in my little community, and at 14, and order whiskey and coke. And I did that one day. And I was with a Marine. I never did hang around boys my age. I always hang out with guys a little bit older than I was. I know it's a pattern for many alcoholics. And we walked into the saloon, and I ordered a whiskey and coke, and I had a cigarette in my mouth. You know, that Lucky Strike cigarette, if y'all remember what Lucky Strike used to be. I see a few smiles. Yes, y'all do. Okay? And nowadays, kids don't do that, go in saloons at 14 years old and with a cigarette in their mouth and order whiskey and coke. They smoke pot in the classroom and shoot up in the basement. You know? But I did that, and I walked in the saloon, and I ordered, and this woman says, she was a beautiful woman. She owned the place. And she says, aren't you young to be drinking? Now, you know, I was a potential alcoholic or alcoholic or whatever. And that embarrassed the hell out of me. There isn't anything more embarrassing to the alcoholic when you put him down with somebody you're trying to impress. And I looked at that woman, and I said to myself, I said, I'll revenge for what she embarrassed me this way. And I did. It took me 7 years. 7 years to revenge. I married her only daughter. And that's my boogie-woogie. I used to tell the story that I met her doing the boogie-woogie in the bar. But I don't tell the whole true story. Somebody talked about it last night. We didn't tell the whole truth. We're not lying, but we didn't fill in the detail. She used to dance in the bar, but she was about 5 or 6 years old. You see? But I tell her that, yeah, I saw her one night. She was doing the boogie-woogie in the bar, and I looked at it, and I said, I want it. She said, if you want it, you got to marry it. And that wasn't true neither. Oh. I'm glad she didn't quote the big book. She says, if you want what I have, and I'm not going to say any more of the rest, you can read it. You can read it. Ed talked about his war experiences. I'm a Korean veteran. I fought like hell, but they drafted me anyway, Ed. And that was about the extent of my career. I stayed in Korea for a whole year. And the good thing that came out of that Korean experience is that when we married, we went on the honeymoon for 9 days, and then I went away for a whole year. And I came back, and I was in the service for about 21. They drafted me. I wasn't that fool enough to go volunteer. Dad. And I stayed in the service 18 for 18 months. I made one strike, and then the following month I went AWOL, and then they busted me. But that wasn't my fault. Alcoholic don't take the blame for nothing. It was Boogie's fault. It was her fault. Because she said that she was so terrific that maybe I should stay a few days extra. And I did. And in the Army, they just don't like that. They're very strict. Let me bring you to 1969. When I came to Alcoholic Anonymous, you told me that God works through people and events. And I believe that. I want to share to you what happened to me in 1969. And I didn't sober up in 1971. I was over at a retreat. I do believe that God's graces was beginning to work in my life, most probably all of my life, but I never knew that they were there. And I went to a retreat, what they call it, the Manresa Retreat House, put on by the Jesuits. It's on the river in Conmouth, Louisiana. And it's an old building. It's a very spiritual environment. The grounds are kept magnificent. They have these rows of oak trees with the drooping moss. And it's a terrific place for retreat. And I had been going there already since 1953. I've been going there for quite a few years. And I went there every year, and I drank while I was going there. My wife told a story once I heard that I used to put whiskey in my suitcase to go to the retreat. And maybe this is why at this retreat one of the priests said, if you go to that oak tree over there and you don't see God, he says, you're mad. So I went to the oak tree. I went to that oak tree. And I looked in there, and I didn't see God. But I didn't know what he meant. I know what he means today, talking about the spirituality, or maybe the presence of God in an oak tree. But making this retreat, come Friday night, I'm sitting in a library with a room much, much smaller than this, with many chairs, and in one of those chairs there's a little pamphlet. And I picked up the pamphlet and it said, 13 steps to alcoholism, which step are you on? That was in 1969. Never. I didn't leave Golden Meadow to come here and lie to you. Never in my life have I heard anything about what an alcoholic was or anything about alcoholism or anything of that nature. If I had heard it, it was a total block. And they had 12 questions. 12 questions. And it says to be honest for the first time in your life. It was a 12 question about drinking. Nobody's looking over your shoulders. And he says, answer the question truthfully. And out of a possible score of 100, I scored 125. I knew definitely that I was an alcoholic by reading this pamphlet. It amazes me to stand here tonight to tell you that I knew nothing about alcoholism, and I lived in that environment all of my life, working in these saloons. When I went to college, my father had never had an education. My mother never spoke a word of English in her life. And they sent me, I had a 4-year paid education in the palm of my hands. And I went for one semester. I flunked out because I wasn't going to classes, because I was drinking too much. And when I came back, he said, son, he said, what do you want to do with your life? And I said, I want to be a bartender. Alcoholic thinking. And this is why I can say that I didn't know anything about this, what an alcoholic was. I saw the guy come to my bar, the bar my father owned, and he would drink beer and get drunk, and he'd throw up his teeth, and then he'd wash them in the beer and put them back in the mouth. You know, that's the type of place I worked. First class, you know. We had a gold spittoon for dignity. That's what we had. And but coming back to to this retreat, I knew definitely that I was an alcoholic. Now the next day, I've been going to Manresa now for 30 years. Never have I heard it before, since, and most probably will never hear again what this retreat master said. He says, men, he says, if anybody here has a problem, he says, I would like for you to write a letter to God and tell him your problem. He says, put it in the form of a prayer and a petition. And he says, God will answer your letter in his own time and in his own way. Well, I had found out the day before that I was an alcoholic. I believed that with all my heart. I believed that I was. So I knew that I had a problem. So I went to my room and I started my letter. I said, Dear God, and I thought alcohol, that it was a vice. I said, the vice in my life is that I am an alcoholic, and if the forward progress is not arrested, I am to die the alcoholic death. And before that, I would lose my wife, my job, respect, and self-respect. You see, I was looking for fancy words. I had never written to God before. So, and then in the second paragraph, the God of my understanding in those days, who had a personal name, I said, Lord Jesus, help me. Very simple. And then in the third paragraph, which I believe had been the most significant part of my letter, was, I said, in any field that would do the job, in any field that would do the job. I didn't ask for Alcoholic Anonymous. I didn't even know there was a program in the world called Alcoholic Anonymous. I didn't know there was one in the United States, the state of Louisiana, and there was a group that was meeting 50 miles from where I live. And so what they did, I came home, and I stayed sober, maybe under religious convictions and a strong faith. I stayed sober for 3 months. I don't recall ever staying sober that long, for many, many years, that I stayed sober for 3 months. But I had nothing to support me. I didn't have a sponsor, which I didn't know what a sponsor was. I didn't have Alcoholics Anonymous, I didn't know where it was. I didn't have anybody to share with. I didn't have anybody to talk to. I was walking on thin ice, and I was about to split. You know, Cajun has these dugout pirogues, they call, canoe, you can call them whatever you want. And you stand up in this pirogue, and you put one foot in there, and you put one foot ashore, and if you don't know what the hell you're doing, you're going to split. Well, that's what happened. I split. I patted myself on the back, said, Joey, you've been so damn good for 3 months, let's have a drink. Let's have a drink. And what I don't have to describe what the drink did. Just like the little squirrel in the cage. The merry-go-round again. To the point that I was hospitalized. And this is where I told you from the beginning, where my sponsor came to talk to me at that time. You see, there's many people that talk to me about my drinking. My wife, my friends, the law, my boss. It was never until a member of Alcoholics Anonymous came and he talked to me about his drinking. You know, I cried out my soul out one time in the confessional with a Catholic priest and to tell him about my problem. Now, I don't know if this priest ever seen the spirit, but believe me, he could smell it that day. And he says, I don't think we're here at the proper time. Like, yeah, they had other people waiting. He says, why don't you come to the rectory? You know, alcoholic, nothing in moderation. Right now, the hell with you, goodbye. And that's what I did. So here I am in the hospital where I said that my sponsor came to see me. And he says, Joey, he says, why don't you come to a meeting? Why don't you come to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous? I said, Mr. Frank, I will. You see, I went for all the wrong reason, but regardless of what reason I went, I went. I didn't go to Alcoholics Anonymous to sober up. I don't know too many people that have been here for 20 years. A new member comes to the podium and he looks at the 12 steps and the 12 tradition and he says, this is what I've been waiting for all of my life. Never heard it said yet. And I didn't want sobriety. I wanted to find a new way of life. I wanted to, I wanted to drink and not get drunk. That's what I wanted to do. So he said, why don't you come to AA? I said, I will, Mr. Frank. And here, I brought my wife with me. In those days, they had one meeting a week, 50 miles from where I live. And I went to this meeting, and there was an old man sitting on the front row. He, his tongue was sticking out, and he, I found out he had physical problems from drinking. I was all dressed up, suited up, to show up. And I looked at him, I said, if he's an alcoholic, I'm not. You know, we can justify anything we want. And this is what I heard. Somebody talked about it this weekend. This is what I heard that wasn't said. I heard two guys talking in the corner. They were talking in the corner. And you know damn well that's what they said. And that's a true story. I heard it last night again. Somebody was mentioning it. They said that I was to come up at this podium and tell everything I had done in my life like an open confession. Well, there were things that I had done that I didn't even whisper to myself when I was hunting in a lonely marsh. I wasn't about to tell these drunks, especially my wife was sitting in the front row. I was in enough hot water. I wasn't about to open up the wrong faucet. And I said, I made a profound statement. I will never, ever come back to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I left that meeting. And I didn't return until 365 days later. You see, I thought I was a big boss. I worked for a company where they talked like millions, like I talk about pennies. And I was in charge of that purchasing department. They were building vessels in the company I was working, like 20 at a time. And I was buying all that equipment. And if you are a purchasing agent, there is no better job if you're a practicing alcoholic and a purchasing agent, there is no better job in the world, because you get the salesman to give you anything you want. And that's the lifestyle that I had, with the drinking cane, gangrene of the soul, that I call. And I was entertaining all kind of entertainments. And I thought I was a big boss. If I wasn't, I made myself one. B-O-S-S. And then I come to find out in Alcoholic Anonymous, boss spelled backwards is a double S-O-B. And I'm not going to tell you too much about the progressiveness of the disease within that year. That's from 365 days, but we all know how progressively it gets, and I heard it about the DTs and the hallucinations. And I used to sit, I heard somebody say, I thought he was telling my story, I think it was one of the chairmen, that he used to sit in bed and he used to talk to these voices. And I used to sit in bed and I talk to these voices, and then I'd answer them. And they did talk back. Boogie would say, there's nobody in the room. Don't tell me there's nobody in the room. There's only crazy people who hear voices when that's not there. And the hallucination that I used to see. People talk about frightful animals that they see, snakes. I saw fish. I was fishing on a yacht. I was entertained. And I was up on the top deck. And all of a sudden, there's a monstrous fish that came on top of the water. And all around that fish was other fish, which I was not able to identify. They didn't look right. And I called the guys that we were fishing with. I said, hey guys, come see. Look at all the fish. Look at the monster over there. And they looked. They said, Joe, there's nobody there. Boy, that infuriated the hell out of me, because you see them, right? I said, there they are. Don't tell me you can't see these fish, these monsters. And then they all laughed. He said, poor T. Joe had a sunstroke. Have another drink. They didn't see what I saw. And to the point that from the progressiveness of my disease and to the very bad experience one night, I woke up the next morning. I won't go into the detail about it. The very next morning when I got up, my son had brought me to bed. And when I got up the next morning, instead of my regular routine of putting the whiskey in my coffee so I could take the shakes out so I could go to work, I said, bring me back to the hospital. Because I knew the DTs were coming, and they were the most horrifying thing that ever happened to me in my life. But the DTs, and I couldn't handle them sober anymore. And I said, bring me to the hospital. Never, ever to get drunk again. What love, what grace, what happened that very moment of a total surrender, most probably not knowing that I did. I went to the hospital and I called Alcoholic Anonymous. And I called the man who saved my life. He was God's messenger to me. And he came and he talked to me again. You know what he told me? The same story. It's a story of repeat. Told me the same story he told me the first time. He said, if you don't drink, you'll never ever get drunk. What's good for bottled intoxication, Joe, is God's intoxication. He says, we got to come to the meetings of Alcoholic Anonymous. This is where you got to start. And I said, Mr. Frank, I'm ready. But I was in bad shape. I had a fight, or I failed, and I looked bad, and vanity was there. And I didn't want to go to a meeting the way I looked. And he said, why don't you shave? I said, I can't, I'm too nervous. So he called the barber to come and shave me. And this barber shaved me. And after he was done, he says, I just want to let you know, and he was nice about it. He said, the only reason I came to shave you is because the request of this man that you just talked to. He is the most respected citizen in the community. One of the greatest drunk that Thibodaux, Louisiana ever had. He came to be the most respectable person in the world, in that community. And he said, this is why I'm here, that I shaved you. He said, this is the first time I ever leave my shop to come and shave anybody. And he says, I want to let you know that. And I wanted to pay him. He says, no, it's on the house. And I says, thank you very much. This was because of my sponsor. This was because of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I went to the meetings after that. And I want to mention about the horrors of sobriety. They talked about it last night, during the weekend. I call them the horrors of sobriety. I was so miserable being sober that I knew that something was going to happen. And for me to drink was to die, and I didn't want to die. I was going to the meeting. We had one meeting a week. That's all we had. It was an open meeting. I was 50 miles away. When you sober up, you tighten up. I didn't call my sponsor. He would call me once in a while. And it's not every time I went to the meetings. And we got one a week. It's not like in a big city where you can choose 25 places to go on any given night. I'm living way down the bottom. Nobody there but me. As far as going to the meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. So, I was miserable. Even my son said one time, he said, "Dad, you used to smile once in a while when you drank." Now that was a terrific message. I was angry all the time. I didn't know what was happening to me. And I said, if there is no more to this sobriety, it ain't got much here. It ain't much here. So I decided to go back to Manresa where I had written my letter in 1969. But by some mysterious coincidence that it was all canceled, it was canceled. I didn't go. There's a man that walked into my house and he says, he lived 50 miles from where I live. He says, I'm accidentally in the neighborhood. And he says, I'm going to retreat. Would you come with me? And I looked at him, I said, what kind of retreat you talking about? It was a Casio weekend. If you know anything about a Casio weekend, Decolores. And he says, I have come to pick up another guy in the community, but he can't go. There is an opening. Would you come? I said, Bobby, I said, I don't give a damn where you're going. I said, the four walls are crawling in. And I've been in AA for only 2 months. And I know for now that only been for 2 months, for me to drink is to die, and I don't want to die. I said, I'll go with you. I don't care. I didn't know what you were going to. I just wanted to get away. And I went with Bobby to this weekend. When I got there, I found out what it was. I was so raged. They used to call me the Cajun Rager, the Raging Cajun, because I did it, and it was embarrassing. I hit my fist in the wall. On the desk, and I would say, leave me alone. I'm an alcoholic. Big deal. I was sober 2 months. And then the word got around, man, this guy is something else. And this is true, the way I acted like an animal. And then Friday night, this guy comes to the podium, well-dressed, sharp-looking. And he says, Benny, I'm going to give you a talk on piety. Oh, my God, when he said piety, I didn't know what the word piety meant. I didn't give a damn who was a pious person. I wanted to leave from where I was, but I was 200 miles away from home, and they had ducked me. They knew something about me before I got there. I found that out late. And this guy here comes to the forum, like I said, and then he closes the book. He says, my name is Jim Sergi. He says, I am a member of Alcoholics Anonymous in good standing. And he said, I would like to talk to you about God's graces and what Alcoholics Anonymous has done for me today. Well, I stood in attention because this was the second person that I ever talked to about anything about Alcoholics Anonymous. Jim was there. It was a program of attraction rather than promotion. Jim was there as a member of Alcoholics Anonymous carrying the message to the sick alcoholic. Recovery begins, the big book says, when one alcoholic talks to another alcoholic about his experience, strength, and hope. And this was the second person that I ever talked to on a one-on-one. And Jim was the type of guy. I can do it today. I can go up to you and hug you and kiss you, and it doesn't bother me. Jim was that type of a guy. But when I was sober 2 months, don't come and hug me, brother. Don't come and... You see, I thought there was something wrong with Jim. And he wasn't about to come and hug me. But I come to find out that this was because of being a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he said, Joe, he said, so we went together. We stayed together for the whole weekend. This member of AA and myself. And he says, Joe, he said, and never in my life have I heard anybody tell anything about himself like he talked about himself. Some of the things that he told me, I would never believe another person would tell another person. And I was a total stranger to him. You know, and that was that element of the unknown, that fear of the unknown. I started to open up and tell him a few things, but that's something I was hiding. I didn't want to tell him the whole story. And he said, that's something that seemed to be really bothering you, Joe. He said, why don't you go get rid of it? He said, why don't you get rid of this garbage that you got? He said, something is really bothering you. I said, yes, Jim, there is. He says, if you don't want to give it to me, he says, go give it to the Catholic priest. Now when he says Catholic priest, I knew that he wouldn't tell anybody. So I went to him, unless they're going blackouts, you know, I don't know. But I went and I told him the things that I had done. You see, and it says that we take that strong action to clean house and trust God. And that's what I did that weekend. I knew that I was an alcoholic when I got there. And I came to believe there was something greater than myself that could restore me. Not to sobriety, but to sanity. And then every day I did something within God's will, because I did, and I told this priest my whole story. And a big book says that maybe until we tell our whole story, we will never recover. So regardless of how I did it, when I did it, or the way that I did it, being in the program 2 months, I had to start with, I believe, with forgiveness. To continue to where I was going in Alcoholics Anonymous. And this priest said, Joe, he says, I forgive you. God forgive you. Now you've got to forgive yourself. And I think forgiveness is not an option. So I felt very good about what I did. And I came back home. And I'll tell you what Boogie said. She said that she had never seen such a personality change come about from what had happened, from my experience of doing the best I could with what I had in getting rid of all this garbage. And it says in the appendix, a personality change sufficient to bring about recovery from alcoholism had manifested itself among us in many various ways. And this is what happened. Thank God that it happened. Who am I to tell God how to do it? God could and would if he was sought. And this was the beginning. This was the beginning. And you know, when I came back to AA, I thought I was doing it wrong. When I went, they didn't have any study groups, big book studies in AA when I went there, in this little community. It was only open meetings. And after listening to it, and thank God for Charlie and the Black Joe and the White Joe. That today, that there is a different way of doing it. That there is instruction on how to do it. But to be knowledgeable more about our program, Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank God for these guys. But this is the way I did it. And coming back to the community, like I said, I thought I had done it wrong. And then I saw a little writing in the big book. It says, for those of us belonging to a religious denomination, where confession is requested, required, must, and will go to the proper authority whose duty is to receive it. And that's what I did. Exactly what I did. And then when in Bill's story, when I read, he says, I ruthlessly faced my sin and let my newfound friend take him root and branches. And he says, I have never drank since. From that experience, I never got drunk since. So I came back and I got involved. I got into the program, not around the program. I got in. My sponsor used to bring me all over the country in convention. This is why I got maybe got involved in all this. And he would, and after a while, here I am sober 6 months. And things are going good. Things are really going good. And boastfully I said it, you know, I still have that ego problem. and that macho image, you know. And I told a Catholic priest, you know, all of my life I've been involved with these Catholic priests. And now I know why. I sponsored two of them. And believe me, it's so good to sit in the inside confessional box. And they got stories themselves. You know? I can't tell it to you. I'd love to. So I said, I need to work with another alcoholic. Time is getting short, man. You all might be start sitting and start standing. But, and I told him, I said, I need to work with another alcoholic. And I said it very boastfully. And he said, why don't you pray for one? Never occurred to me, you know. So in all my simplicity, I didn't use any fancy prayer like we got the 12-step prayer on page 164. I had heard the word path, P-A-T-C-H. I said, Lord, I said, if I can cross path with another alcoholic, that we could work together, so be it. You see, there's nobody there where I am. There's no group where I live. This is 6 months sober. So, and as God is my witness. The very next day or a few days after, I get a call from another priest, from another rectory, and he says, Joey, he says, there's a man here who says he's an alcoholic. He says, the clothes on his back is what I gave him. He says, he's from many states, and he lives in a bathtub. Would you help him? I said, no. Honestly, I said, no. Because fear engulfed me. I didn't know what to do with a 12-step call. But luckily, he didn't hang up. And I said, I'll talk to him. But you see, and honestly again, the guy that I had prayed for, that was a doctor in the community who needed to go to Alcoholics Anonymous, and that maybe I could have picked him up, and the community would have seen the good job that Joe is doing, bringing that doctor, he would have picked me up in his cataract, you know, big old cataract. And then we were going to the meeting, and after the meeting, he had bought me a steak. This is the guy I had prayed for. I think God was trying to humble somebody. But nevertheless, I talked to Bob. His name was Bob. I talked to Bob on the telephone, and he told me that he played music, which was a damn lie. He never played an instrument in his life, so what I did, my son had about a $300 or $400 trumpet. I brought it to him that night. Tell you how much I knew about a 12-step call, just because he said he played music, I brought him a trumpet. My wife said, that's a bad mistake. This guy sleeps in a bathtub, you're never going to see that trumpet again. And $300 or $400 trumpet in those days, it was expensive, you know, a lot of money. So I was able to get my trumpet back. But you know what happened, let me tell you, cut it short. Bob stayed sober for 10 months. We stayed sober together for 10 months. And then Bob went back to drinking. But we would almost have fist fight, him and I. Almost fist fight. Because he would never do anything of God's will after I thoroughly explained it to him. But Bob got drunk. Bob got drunk, and then I found out later that what happened was that Bob was keeping me sober. That's what was happening. But I didn't know that. Until to the point that my sponsor said one time, he said, I think it's time we should open up a group where you live. You won't have to travel all this distance to come to the meetings. And we did, myself and him, and there were other two or three around, and we were able to start a group down the bar. So it's saved me that trip of traveling 100 miles to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. But we would go to any lengths to stay sober, right? So, at these, and there were times. And there were times when there was myself and just another person at the meeting. But it picked up And thank God today we have a very active group, very active group. You know, I'm going to have to skip a little bit because I want to talk to you about what it is for me today. I'll basically just talk about what it is today. I'm in retirement. I retired March the 1st. Prior to my retirement, 2.5 months before, the company was very generous to me. They let me go 2.5 months before my retirement with full pay and all expenses. I didn't ask for that. My boss offered it to me, and I went for a little bit, and I got a big bit. It's been like that in Alcoholics Anonymous many, many times, not all the time. But every time I went for a little bit, I always got more than I expected. My retirement today is great. To wake up in the morning, to know that I do not have the responsibility of having going to work or labor for another person. But I don't shy away from my responsibility about my spiritual growth or my spiritual activity. I am not a rocking chair retiree. Somebody said, Joe, are you going to grow a garden? I said, no, I haven't got time. I haven't got time to grow a garden. Because I'm very active and I'm not rocking chair retirement. But I use my rocking chair every morning to do my prayer and meditation to start off my day. Now, many times I do not... My plans are not exactly what I planned because I have come to believe that God is my manager, that God manages my life the minute that I get up. And I tell you what I think it came about. Some years back, while I was sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, I made one of the most frightening third-step decisions that I ever made in my life. It was very frightening. I was sitting in my living room one day, and I said, God, I invite you to invade my privacy. I invite you to invade my privacy. I had never had anyone in my life to invade my privacy. And believe me, my life has never have been the same from that very day. One day at a time. You would have told me 20 years ago that I would be here tonight. Today, to speak to you at a podium with all these people looking at me, if they got 500, you got 1,000 eyes looking at me, and sometimes that gets very frightening, because there is no way that I could have done anything of that nature. I even had quit the Rotary Club once because of the process of elimination. I was to have been the vice president, and for me to speak as vice president of that organization, and we were 5 men, I quit the Rotary Club because of my fears and insecurity of speaking to 5 people in a closed room. So true. The fears of riding an automobile in sobriety was a tremendous accomplishment for me. You know, we can laugh about these things today, but they weren't funny then. Believe me, they weren't funny. So it's only, you see, I found out that God and I is an overwhelming majority. There is nothing that I can't do with God. And thank God that today that I can look at all you beautiful people and that I am in a strange town. First time I ever get to Hot Springs, and it's only through God's grace in Alcoholics Anonymous. Because that was the last thing. That would have been the last thing on the list, that from making that commitment when I asked God to invade my privacy, that He would bring me to where I am today in Alcoholics Anonymous, and no big deal, just to come here and share my experience, my strength and hope with people that I love, because I know I love Alcoholics Anonymous. It did not start that way. It did not start that way. I did not love Alcoholics Anonymous, but I believe it came about from taking the action of the program. I really believe that. This is how it got to be that I love AA so much. And come to find out I love AA so much is because these are people that's in Alcoholics Anonymous, like that whole front row and the back row and anywhere else. I want to close with this. It's something that I wrote many years ago, wrote as putting notes on it, and it has something to do with the engines that are in our tugboats, and it has something to do with how I work my program as far as what I understand my program is to be. If I was to put a title on it, in English it would be, if it's working for you, don't fix it. If I was to put a French title on it, I would say, si la poule prépond, mettez pas dans la bombe. That means that if your chicken or your hens is laying eggs, don't put her in the pot. So if it's working for you, don't fix it. And we have an engine. We have all kind of engines in these tugboats: 8-cylinder, 12-cylinder, 16, 20. And I'll stick to the 12 cylinders. And we have an engineer in these vessels. And if that engine is working perfect, on tune, nothing is going wrong, he is not going to tear it down to see why it's working. He's going to let it tune in, let it work. Same thing with my program, as I understand it. If it's working for me, I'm not going to change it, change the word, or switch the steps as to the order they're in, or tear a few pages out of the big book. It's working for me, so I'll leave it just like it is. I'm not going to change anything. It's working. Now, there are cylinders in these vessels. And if there's one of these cylinders that the engineer knows that it's not working, he's going to leave the 11 up alone, and working that one cylinder until he gets it back in tune. And then he pulls that cylinder in tune with the 11 others. Same thing with my program. If I know which step is not working for me, and it's usually the third step, because it has everything to do with self, I'll work on it until I put it in tune, and I'll leave it alone. I'll leave the 11 others alone. Now, there's a manual on these vessels. Call it preventive maintenance. It's a manual that he reads to keep up with the knowledge and the working activities of his engines, and he reads all of that material so that he can be on top of it. Same thing with me. I got a big book called Alcoholic Anonymous, the Blue Book. And if I, and only for myself, if I feel that this book has saved my life, I feel that it is my responsibility to see what the hell I got in this book. For these first 164 pages, for me to know what's in this book, because it has saved my life. And one other thing, this engine has a, somebody in Detroit made that engine. Nobody knows about it more than this guy in Detroit. If that engine goes kaput, everything goes wrong. That engineer can call the engineer can call that maker in Detroit and tell him what the problem is, and this guy can tell him everything what's wrong with the engine over the phone. The same thing with myself. I have a maker. If I know that everything is wrong, everything is kaput, I can turn to my maker. And I found out God has an 800 number. You call 1-800 himself, H-I-M-S-E-L-F. I did that once. I called 1-800 himself. Nobody answered. I called the number without the 800 number. It's a woman that answered. I said, oh my God, God is a woman. But nevertheless, I can call, I can talk to my maker, and my maker will direct, he's not going to tell me directly what's wrong with it, but he will direct me to people that knows my problem, and there's no one else that knows my problem more that can help me and solve the solution of my problem than members of Alcoholics Anonymous. And now I want to close by giving you a little gift. It's something I do everywhere as I go. It's a prayer card. It has nothing to do with Alcoholics Anonymous. It has no name, phone number, or address on this card. It's a gift from me, from you, for being so kind and loving to me this morning and for the whole weekend. And it's a little gift of appreciation. It's a prayer that's written by Thomas Merton. I didn't know Thomas Merton had wrote the prayer, so I didn't know who Thomas Merton was, and I changed a few words in it to fit my environment. I hope that Thomas Merton does. He was a monk from the Kentucky Hills, the monastery of the Kentucky Hills, and I hope he doesn't mind me changing these words in his prayer wherever you are, Thomas, and that you can take these cards and do whatever you want with them. I have brought 500 of them. My wife will put them on the table here. Free to take one and do whatever you want with it. You can use it for bookmark. Give it to a friend, take a few and give them out. And I am so generous with my cards because the guy who prints them doesn't charge me. And then a few years later, I found a guy on the beach, which fits my environment, and there's a picture of a guy on the beach. He's looking at the vast ocean and the beautiful sky. And he says, thank you, God, for all you have given me. And thank you, God, for all you have taken away from me. And thank you, God, for all you have left me. And I think the greatest thing that you ever left me is what I read in our big book on the first page, where it says, we of Alcoholics Anonymous, who have recovered from a seamless, hopeless state of mind and body. You know, people, we have come from loss to usefulness. God did not make junk. Thank you very much.